This is the Mountain Muse radio program with Emmy DeGreppa, and today we are talking to Duane Hardy, wildlife painter and the 2011 Fall Arts Festival featured artist. Duane is a wildlife painter from Saskatchewan, Canada, who now makes his home in the United States, Jackson specifically. Three dozen of his oil paintings are at the center of an exciting exhibition called Yellowstone to Yukon Journey of the Wildlife and Art, which just finished its debut at the National Museum of Wildlife Art here in Jackson and is bound next year for the White Museum of the Canadian Rockies in Banff National Park. The Yellowstone to Yukon exhibition is an assemblage of paintings and sculptures by prominent American and Canadian nature artists who over two centuries were drawn to the Rockies, specifically to the Yellowstone to Yukon corridor that stretches 2,000 miles. The exhibition features famous pieces by famous artists such as Carl Rungis, Charles Russell, Thomas Heal, Bob Kuhn, and Tiger Smith, Jim Wilcox, just to name a few, and is heralded by critics as a must-see event. Duane's role in this exhibition was to paint in the footsteps of Carl Rungis 100 years later, but currently front and center is Duane's Fall Arts Festival painting titled Strength and Vulnerability, a painting depicting the globally infamous grizzly bear, the grizzly bear mother known as number 399 and her triplet cubs, and he is getting ready to do her daughter number 610. The original oil will be auctioned off September 17th on the town square as part of the Jackson Hole Fall Arts Festival Quick Draw Art Sale and Auction. Whew. Wow, Duane. Welcome.
Well done, Amy. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I wanted to give that background to give you so that the listening audience and understand some of the very significant questions that I'm going to ask you about your painting, your growing up in Canada, and your relationship to painting wildlife and 399 and her cubs specifically. But first of all, how do you feel about painting in the footsteps of Carl Rungis 100 years later, as you did in this exhibition?
Well, it's a great privilege. And I think what really sunk in deeply for me, having spent 1 month on horseback, packing up at high elevations, cresting mountain passes and living the life in the trail was how tough a human being he really was to be so self-sufficient in all kinds of situations of potential duress when you're on your own, alone, packing by on a horseback with no one but yourself to rely on and with the intent of painting plein air and gathering some artistic reference. There are a whole series of contingencies that you have to be encyclopedic in survival skills. And I think, believe he was, and he was tough as a man, great as a painter. I really didn't get that until I experienced it myself.
That's lovely to hear you talk about it like that. And then you started painting the infamous grizzly bear 399. How did that connection with nature and Carl Rungis and your growth in painting connect you with 399?
Well, prior to completing 399, Strength and Vulnerability, I'd spent a year here working on the 30 easel pieces for the exhibition at the museum. So I'd kind of reached a peak of proficiency, and then the finale was Bear 399. So for me as an artist, it was building up to that point, and I think it shows in the work. But studying grizzlies and watching, incidentally, I saw her daughter, 610, about a month ago in Willow Flats, just near Jackson Lodge, pursuing some elk for her twin cubs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know where else in the world you can stop at the edge of a highway and view that type of wildlife dynamic only a quarter mile away and clearly see what she was trying to do, what she was trying to strategize. They're very intelligent animals.
Did you capture that on film?
It was quite a ways away, but I watched it intently with the binoculars, and it was so cool. Mm-hmm. She charged five or six times over a period of 2 hours, unsuccessfully. The cubs didn't seem to care. They were just in the meadow batting one another around and having a good time.
Being kids.
Yeah, exactly.
So in respect to your life in Canada, because I know how long have you lived here in the United States now?
Oh, gosh, I've lived and worked here for the past 7-8 years and been back and forth to Toronto on several occasions, north of Toronto, work assignments as well.
But you grew up in Saskatchewan.
I did, on a very rural environment, ranching, farming, and spent a lot of time mucking out the stalls with the cattle in the barn and helping my uncles on the ranch or the farm, throwing hay bales in the summer. That's how I got in shape for football every summer, throwing hay bales for a month.
Good job, Dwayne. Yeah. I didn't know that about you. So how did that life, growing up in rural ranch in Canada, prepare you to be a wildlife artist?
It didn't really prepare me to be an artist per se. What it did was it sunk the love of the land into me. Our families would camp, and I'd often fish and hunt with my father in the fall, every fall. It was like a tradition. So just the things that seep into your bones about the land and being close to it, that really encapsulates my father. He loved the land. He was a farmer, and probably would have loved to have stayed on the farm if he could have. But in any event, that's really what it was. It really sunk into me in terms of the love of the land and watching closely the shift of the clouds and the light. Yeah.
And do your parents still alive? Are they still living on the ranch?
No, my father passed 3 years ago now. Mm-hmm. My mother's still alive. Mm-hmm. And they had a very, very close relationship. In fact, Mom still keeps my father's T-shirt from the hospital under her pillow.
Oh.
Yeah.
How did that influence your life to enter into the art world, in terms of what were the great influences besides growing up on the ranch that made you decide to become an artist?
Well, I think essentially for any child growing up, it's the familial support. You know, Mom and Dad were always supportive. I can't say they always understood an art path, but they were supportive of their children. So that's the initial great boon for any young person is their support from their mother and father. But from there on, you know, we moved out of the rural environment into a larger city, which had a wonderful natural history museum. And I met the art staff at that museum when I was, I think, 12, 13 years old, and was fascinated first by the taxidermy specimens, I think probably because of my experience hunting and fishing with my father.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, filleting a fish and dressing out a pheasant. And then all of a sudden I saw this wonderful thing you could create from them rather than having them table fare. They became these works of art. And that fascinated me. And then for a while, I think I enrolled in a taxidermy course when I was 12 or 13 years old. But then the art kind of started to take over.
Mm-hmm.
And that encouragement from the art staff really was the beginning of propelling myself forward into the art world.
Do you remember your first art teacher, your first art class?
I do. I also remember my first taxidermy specimen that I tried and it was terrible.
What was it?
It was a Richardson's ground squirrel, and it looked like one of those old snarling grizzly bear mounts. It wasn't all that great. Anyways, that's how we all learn. In terms of my art teacher, it was the first person that really affected me and directed me was a fellow by the name of Fred Larman, who was the staff taxidermist at the museum at the time. And he was nothing but encouragement. We had a lot of fun together. He's an older gentleman. And I'd see him, visit him maybe once a week. And on occasion, he would invite me out to while he was plein air painting, and so I did that.
And oh, so you learned about plein air painting at that time.
I didn't know that's what it was called. I was still pretty young. But it was that same connection with the land, and I just loved to sit on the rocks and watch the sky and try to, you know, watch what he was doing and imitate that. That's the way most kids learn.
And what was his name?
Fred Larman.
Fred Larman. Was he a well-known painter in Canada?
I would say more so in the province of Saskatchewan, not necessarily nationally known at a great degree. Although he did have a certain amount of integration with Tom Mangelson, which is a big name here in the community, in that at the time the Royal Saskatchewan Museum was an epicenter for watching and surveying the migratory path of the whooping crane, which is as you know, endangered, still endangered. Mm-hmm. And Tom Mengelson knew the staff at the museum in Regina quite well and would, early in his career, mm-hmm. drive up to Saskatchewan where he would photograph the cranes with Fred Larman and Fred Bard, who was then, at that point, the director of the museum.
Oh, nice. So after, well, going back to your taxidermy days.
Yes.
So this same gentleman also mm-hmm. taught you about taxidermy, or no?
He did. He was both a taxidermist and a painter.
Okay.
He had, early in his career, at the inception of the Royal Saskatchewan mm-hmm. Museum, had traveled to New York City and the Field Museum in Chicago to acquaint himself with the great masterworks of diorama, the art of the diorama at both of those museums.
So give me a definition of what does it mean when you say diorama?
A diorama, I guess typically most people would know them at the large natural history institutions where they incorporate a painted background, mm-hmm. very large in scale, and the taxidermy specimens in the foreground, as well as the three-dimensional fabrication of the plants or the leaves or whatever the habitat is that the animal's walking through or standing in.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what is the largest mammal that you created at taxidermy? What would you call it? Sculpture? Is it not mm-hmm. a sculpture, a taxidermy?
Well, it's a mannequin. It's what the hide is put
okay.
over top of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would have been a cougar.
A cougar?
Yeah, I assisted in that. Cougar and a caribou at one point, yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
So how do you go about, is this an animal that you are going to hunt anyway as a hunter? Or mm-hmm. do you go out looking for the right specimen to?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
And most of that is put forward by the curators of an institution in that they identify both the location and the species that they want to present in the diorama.
Right.
So we take the directives from them. And then the curatorial staff and the art staff work really closely to develop both the idea and the finished work of art as dioramas truly are. Yeah, Dr. Karen Wonders out of Calgary wrote her thesis on the diorama. I think she's now splits her time between Germany and Sweden, but her four years of interviewing institutions across North America, both Canada and the U.S., would indicate that dioramas are still the most effective educational tool and the most compelling of any of the large natural history institutions.
I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
So tell us about your experiences as an artist that still affect you right now, today, in your painting.
Right. Well, I think my friendships with my colleagues and mentors. I mean, we've had some wonderful times together, mm-hmm. working mm-hmm. outside and getting into some funny and interesting situations. they make life interesting. On my pack trip with Wayne Sawchuk into the Muskoka Chica, that was a real exercise in self-sufficiency and surprises. One day we wrangled the horses back in the morning, and one of the horses had been attacked by a grizzly bear. you could see the claw marks across the rump of the horse, very clearly defined. It hadn't broken the skin, but it had raked all the hair off of the hind end of the horse. Yeah, so didn't stop us in any way because the horse wasn't injured, truly. But it made us aware of the fact that just we were in grizzly country and we had to be cognizant of that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So tell me about I think it's interesting that you developed a relationship with Ted Turner mm-hmm. and that you did a painting for him that was depicting, was it wolves?
It was wolves. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that painting.
The idea behind the wolf painting came at a point when he had cordoned off a holding area for wolves that were brought to him from an abandoned den, and his intent was to introduce those wolves to his Flying D Ranch property, which he did, mm-hmm. and that became the essence of the painting. To realize in that painting, the reestablishing of a natural ecosystem where the wolves would predate on the bison and the elk.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel personally about that? Because that's a controversial issue.
It is. It is. And I appreciate the various levels that it impacts, you know, the vested parties. From my perspective, having spent, you know, the afternoon with Mr. Turner, it was fascinating to hear how passionate and understanding he was, and both in terms of a wolf reintroduction and his desire to reintroduce the bison at large on his ranch. Mm-hmm. And he was just encyclopedic in his knowledge of bison, and in particular the importance, the significance the bison were to the Native peoples. Culture. They were everything mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. the Native Americans. In that era, without the bison, their peoples, their culture was bereft. And he had this very understanding view of the significance of the bison in that context. It's great to hear him talk about it. He's just infinitely knowledgeable about it.
How would you describe your values in terms of conservation and your work as a wildlife artist?
Well, you know, growing up on a ranch, they're pretty practical, pragmatic people. and it's, to me, it's always about balance.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that people need housing, they need jobs, they need a car to drive, but I want my children to have the opportunity, children and grandchildren, to be able mm-hmm. to have the opportunity to experience true, untouched wilderness as much as we can possibly have, mm-hmm. and working to that equilibrium is not an easy thing sometimes, because there are resource interests, there are conservation interests, and unless we can negotiate to a balance, mm-hmm. One is always going to suffer for the other, and I would tend to be on the conservation side, because beauty, the natural beauty of the world, and the part of it that occupies our inner humanity, I believe if we lose that, we've lost something that's tremendously important to ourselves as human beings.
When did you gain that perspective, Duane? I mean, in what part of your career did you realize the role that conservation and art come together and one reflects the other?
Well, it's been a growing understanding, and much of it is in terms of resolving problems and understanding the world. Much of it revolves around science, mm-hmm. and the science of, numbers of square miles needed for a grizzly bear. That's pretty cut and dry. Mm-hmm. For them to exist and survive as they truly are.
Mm-hmm.
But that tends to be a little dry to the average person. I think the things that speak to us emotionally, I truly saw at a peaked and heightened awareness when I was traveling in this mountainous corridor in preparation for the show, for the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you see nature untouched and the animals interacting as they naturally would, it becomes both a privilege but a responsibility
mm-hmm.
to preserve that and sustain it as best we can. After all, we are simply as well. We are just a part of the natural world, and the natural world, whether it's a plant or an animal,
mm-hmm.
mammal, are indicators. And mm-hmm. as they decline, we can be assured that we are being impacted in the same way that they are. We may survive it a little bit better. But the impact and the shift and changes in our environment are still present.
Mm-hmm. Which animals did you kind of grow to have an affinity for as you started painting and learning about them?
I've had the notable experience to become known as the pika painter. I say that tongue in cheek. they're the cutest little things. And
okay, now you have to say, what is a pika? What is a pika?
A pika is a very small rodent that's extremely sensitive to climate change and lives at high elevations where they need to be living at a rather cool climate. Mm-hmm. And as the temperatures are warming, they're being forced higher and higher. And there is evidence that in some areas, such as Colorado, the populations are declining rapidly because of that shift in temperature.
Did you find a pika on your journey?
I did. The colony of pikas that I gathered my reference material from was a small colony just south of Jasper. And so I spent most of one afternoon sketching and photographing them.
Oh.
They have the loudest voice for such a small creature. They're a lot of fun. They're fascinating. And after a while, they come quite habituated to your presence, so they would come within feet of where I was.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, just making their little rounds, gathering grasses. And it's great.
How did you become known as the pika artist?
Well, I say that tongue-in-cheek. I really love the big game, the larger fauna, grizzly, mm-hmm. moose, elk, bear.
Mm-hmm.
And, the pika identity evolved actually curiously from the selection of the National Museum of Wildlife Art. When I started the exhibition, one of the agreements was that both the National Museum of Wildlife Art and mm-hmm. the Peter and Catherine White Museum in Banff, both institutions will host a show, and both I had an agreement with both that they could choose one painting for each of their permanent collections. So the Wildlife Art Museum here in Jackson chose the pika painting.
That's great.
Ergo Hardy, the pika painter.
Yeah. Instead of the grizzly.
Yes.
Well, what can you share with other artists as they grow in their art? What kind of insights as you've grown as an artist? And what have you learned and valued? And what can you share with other artists?
Well, art is a matter of the heart, whether it's painting, sculpture, dance, literature. It's a matter of people's perception and working from the heart. And in that regard, I think it really is a relationship to develop along that path and being with good people. Mm-hmm. From a technical viewpoint, just viewing great art, if you happen to be an artist with an interest in wildlife or landscape or portraiture, mm-hmm. studying great art, mm-hmm. going to the cultural centers in North America and standing in front of a Rembrandt or a Carl Rungis, the approach is so much more visible and can be internalized to such a greater degree if you see an original work of art. Mm-hmm. And that's where this mm-hmm. community is enormously blessed,
right.
by having the National Museum of Wildlife Art and the extremely high quality that the collector's circle and the founders continue to ensure. It's a treasure. It really is a great institution.
So true. So, Duane, do you think it's necessary as an artist to go and to an art school and graduate with an art degree?
Oh, boy. I don't know if I'm going to take the bait on that one. You know, if you look through the course of art history, some have definitely mm-hmm. Attended fine schools, art schools.
Mm-hmm.
Others are naturally gifted and learn in a different way. Charlie Russell was a great example of a young person with a big heart that came out to the West when he was, I think, 14 years old and settled in Montana and had this immense love of the land and wildlife and people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that he always had something to say. He was never really formally trained, but you can definitely see the shift in ability, technical ability, once he started to mix with his colleagues.
Right.
And once he started to travel, the shift in his ability as a colorist, his ability to draw really accurately was enhanced by going to New York City on invitation mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. people that had an interest in his art, by some of his East Coast artist friends traveling west to visit with him. So, no, I don't think a person necessarily has to go to an art school today, especially if their interest is in a classical arts-oriented curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just as much to be learned through natural talent and by being around other artists and looking at great paintings.
Did you see yourself grow that way? by working with your peers?
I did, and the truth is, there for me as a young person, I'm now 54 years old, so it's stretching back a few years. But as a young person, even though I would have wanted to have gone to an art school in Canada, sad to say, there just simply was not a great art school in that nation that would have given me the type of training that I received in New York City. There was virtually no enhanced, highly cognitive approach to the classical visual arts in Canada at the time. I think it's getting better, but I still admire this nation so much for hanging on to and embellishing and continuing their higher level of arts education in terms of classical realism. And there are some great institutions in this country that young people can depend on.
So as a young person, how did you afford to do that? How did you make that happen?
That's a great question. Well, I won a tiny scholarship to go to New York City. I was 21 years old when I went. But prior to that, I had clenched my teeth and determined that I was going to go on some really solid advice from another Canadian painter. So I worked in Calgary for about a year, year and a half as a bricklayer's helper on the construction site and just took on whatever jobs I could to help support myself to get there.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
To get to your dream.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember I was also working on this construction site as part of the cleanup crew, and I remember cleaning up after the carpenters had finished, vowing that one way or another I was going to get there.
I bet.
Yeah.
That's determination, Duane.
Yeah, it's hard work, and hard work is really important.
So now, what now for you? What do you see for your future?
I'd love to settle here in Jackson. I am intent on achieving that goal as well. Jackson is an amazing community in terms of its support of the arts. I don't really know a community like it. It's, of course, set in this extraordinary place at the foot of the Teton Mountains. And I've made some great friendships here and have so many collegial affiliations, and it's just sunk into me. So I hope to remain here.
Well, good. We hope you remain here, Duane.
Thanks, Emmy.
Thank you so much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. This is Emmy DeGrappa, and this is the Mountain Muse Radio Program.